Good afternoon and welcome to Digging Deep, the farming show on WDRT Community Radio, 91.9 FM and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can listen live or you can go back and find archives for previous shows, including this show, which I'm very happy to have, Rufus Hawkey from Key Waden Farms. We're going to be talking, Joseph and I have, my co-host, have wanted to talk to people who are farming and still doing it, making it work. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. And so welcome, Rufus.
Hey, thanks for letting me be here and talk about something that I love to do.
Oh, yeah, good, yeah. Good. I know you love to do it.
I do.
And you grew up here.
I did. I grew up on the farm that I'm farming on.
That is really cool. And so now are you 40, 45?
Up. I'm 46 now. I'm solidly middle-aged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, my son is, in the upper 30s now.
Yeah.
But, are you considered a native?
Okay.
You're born here, right?
Right into the controversy, huh? Right? I consider myself a native, yeah. I mean, I have lived on that land most of my life. I did a little stint in Colorado for a couple years, mm-hmm. but most of my life I have been on that land. So I think, for whatever that's worth, 40 years of my existence as a human being has been on that piece of property.
And I think that's great. And, that used to be so much the story out here. And when I moved out here in the 70s, there was a flight to the city and a lot of, the land was really cheap and the young people were leaving because there really wasn't much for them. And
yeah, that's continued through my life, too. But, it's kind of what I think about is that you guys actually, like my parents, I can include my parents in this.
Yeah.
You guys, you really did the opposite thing. Both my parents came from cities, and, they were back to landers.
Right.
And I just think it's kind of amazing when most of the people were zigging, they zagged a little bit, you guys zagged a little bit and created this awesome environment that we live in now in this area.
Well, we kind of kept it alive.
Yeah, I shouldn't say create, right? There was lots of small farms, actually.
Yeah, so many of us have wonderful stories of our neighbors who helped us out, kind of took pity on us, saw that we really didn't know much. I was very idealistic, and back to the land, we're going to just live off the land.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to be organic, not knowing anything about, organic.
Sure.
And not much about farming, but kind of idealizing it and getting a great, great price on the land, which is Joseph and my co-host, Joseph Childs. We talk about this a lot because mm-hmm. young people who didn't inherit a farm are looking at land prices that are just, out of sight.
Right.
And you're not going to make money, milking cows or, selling a few eggs so Joseph and I really wanted to do some interview people who are on the land still. Mm-hmm. I want to go back with you a little bit of your history because I know, things have really changed in the last 40 years on the farm.
Yeah.
And what your parents did, they did dairying.
It was a dairy farm when it's growing up, yeah.
And I'm not even sure Organic Valley existed then.
Not in the beginning.
So it was a matter of marketing your milk somehow.
Right. I mean, they had a registered Holstein herd of 60 cows. My father still is really into the genetics of the animals. And so he had, some top-notch cows that had he had production records for Richland County and, was kind of well known within that small circle of dairy farms.
Right.
And so, it was a real true blue farm, and that existed until mid-90s, and then it went away, like a lot of farms, but that was his primary occupation. Yeah.
Right. Do you have an understanding of what really was happening there in, the 80s?
I have more of a an understanding now as an adult, but as a kid, no, I didn't really see anything happening. Probably till I was a teenager. In my teenage years, that's when stuff was getting pretty bad on a lot of farms, as far as you just weren't making it as a business and
not getting enough money for the milk.
not getting enough money for the milk. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's what, you know, and we got into the dairy goat business, Bob Beeson and I, and I know my husband knew you and dairy farmers, but we could see that if you have fluid milk, you just have to sell it. I mean, you can't keep it around. And the goat farmer said, well, let's have a co-op. Let's hire our own cheese maker. Let's make it into cheese as fast as we can. Then we can refrigerate it. Then we can hold it. We can age it. We can even find some our markets ourselves. But we didn't know anything about business, and we didn't know anything about cheese, and nobody was really into goat cheese at that time. It was too early. I never even heard the word chef until decades later. But we were making kind of a cheddar cheese, and yes, we sold to the big food co-op distributors and stuff like that. But I mean, it really was like, hey, farmers, you're subject to the milk marketing board or something like that, and they just set a price, and that's what you get.
Well, okay, I can give you my street understanding of what happened. You know, I think essentially we had a system in place until about the mid '80s that tied the price of milk to inflation, and that went away. And so, and there was a real big push in the USDA to consolidate farms and consolidate production, and so, you know, and that kind of manifests through the universities pushing productions. Styles, you know, that was all about, you know, production. And so, you know, the 60 cow dairy became the thing that wasn't really efficient in that small scope of things. And just a lot of these farms had to go away because they just couldn't keep up with the price of equipment, you know, the price of cows, price of everything, just living. You know, because you're basically the pay price, and it's still kind of the same. Like the pay price of milk is, you know, it was the same as when my parents ended in '96. The price was still the same as when they started in, you know, 20 years ago or 20 years before that. So you know, you couldn't. Most farms couldn't keep up with that, and there was a push to consolidate. So, like in the state of Wisconsin now, there's the same amount of cows that have been in the state forever. But I think there's only 60 some thousand farms, dairy farms left where there used to be 600,000, you know, or more.
Oh, yeah, you know, much smaller farms. And
and
you know, Joseph and I have bemoaned the fact that, you know, along with those small farms and many of them, you know, big changes happened in the towns.
Oh yeah, I think that's the biggest thing.
Oh gosh, you know, you just don't realize. But I suppose it happens in cities where, you know, some big employer moves out, a factory moves out. It does the same thing. I mean,
the interesting thing about the changes in the little towns is that, and this maybe this again same in the cities. I don't know, but it happens so slowly, you know, that you don't really recognize it, and. You know, as a kid growing up in this area, like when we were going to school, we were really encouraged, like, you got to go to college, you got to get out of here, you got to go, you know, the world is out there, which is a good thing to do, leave a place.
And you left.
I did, yeah, absolutely.
My son did too. Yeah. And found out this is a great place to live.
I did find that out.
Isn't it wonderful?
I mean, it is really cool, yeah. I mean, I feel very fortunate because when I graduated from high school in '96, I had absolutely no desire to be here. No, I was going to go be an actor somewhere, probably in L.A.
I know that dream.
Right, yeah. Never even got close to that. But, you know, so I did a year of college down at Whitewater as a theater major. And then I was like, well, this is kind of ridiculous. I think I need to, figure out what I want to do in life. And the only thing I really knew was I loved skiing. And it looked like that would be fun, and so I just kind of packed up my bags and headed out to Colorado and lived in a ski resort for 5 years. And Winter Park is where I was at, Winter Park, Grand Lake area, right across the divide from Denver. Awesome. Had a great time. Met some lifelong friends, you know.
Oh, what a wonderful, priceless experience.
Oh, it was so incredible. Yeah. But I did keep coming back here, you know, so that was like, the farm was still there. You know, my parents weren't farming anymore. They had gone through a divorce. It was kind of a rough time, right? But fortunately, through wisdom or luck or whatever, they held on to the land. And the land itself, the farm, is 200 acres, so it's a big chunk of land, you know. And they held on to it, and so it was there for me to keep coming back to and visit. And, you know, it was like every time I would come back, I would just be like, wow, discover something new about this place. Like, you see it in a new light, you know, catch it in the spring when the flowers are out and the grass is green. And, you know, it's just like all these different beautiful things that this area gives us. My eyes were becoming more open to it. And then, you know, I mean, I could see living in the mountains forever because it's beautiful out there too. But I think one summer I grew a garden out there. And I was out at like 9,000 feet elevation.
Colorado doesn't have a very long growing season.
No, it snowed every month of the year, every month, June, July. You know, it would snow, but it wouldn't stay around in the town we were in. But it would still be like you'd wake up and there'd be a couple inches of snow. So I just had a really little garden, and I built a little hoop frame over it. You know, got some horse manure from a guy. You know, did all these different things. And I grew radishes and spinach and some salad mix. And I would come home from work and just look forward to that little salad and checking out my garden. And it just really started the wheels turning in my head about, like, the freshness of food and growing my own garden. And then, like, you know, I was getting to that age. I was, like, getting to about 24, 25. And I was like, what do I really want to do? Like, what resources, what assets am I going to have, do I have in life? And it's like, I got a strong body. I know how to work because I've been a farm kid. And the farm's still there. And then my pops, he went into teaching, shop teaching. He just had a semester left to finish. And so he finished that semester and went to being a teacher for his second career. But he was over in Plymouth, Sheboygan area, so other side of the state. And he was just kind of wondering, like, you know, do I hold on to the land? Do I get rid of it?
You know, oh, boy.
All of us kids were way far away. He hadn't really vocalized yet that there was an interest there.
And the land prices are really climbing.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's because people are using land as investment.
Nowadays, absolutely.
And they're not, 100%. You know, it's just like the stock market or something. And it's not really, I mean, the price of land out here is between $7,000 and $10,000 an acre now.
Sure.
And that's an entire year's salary.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that just, it doesn't make sense. And it isn't really, you know, you wonder, how can you farm?
Well,
what can you do? What can you
do? It's challenging. And I mean, I think so. So for me, Dad, he was like, well, I'm going to sell my chunk. And he put the for sale sign out there. And I happened to just be coming back, right? And I drive in the driveway and the for sale sign's out there. And it really was like that gut-wrenching, like, also like nervous excitement of like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to try to move back. I'm going to try to buy a chunk of the farm and start farming. And the cool, again, back to the cool thing of this area, right? There's all kinds of really awesome small scale farms that are out here. And so this would have been early 2000s. There was a farm, Avalanche Organics. It was right on 131 between Viola and Reedstown. And it was a 60 acre produce operation. And I drove back past it one day and was like, oh, wow, this is different. You know, the fields all had different colors and textures out there. It wasn't just corn and beans or alfalfa. It was like, this is interesting. And so I pulled in, and I had my CDL at the time, and they were like, we're looking for a driver. And yeah, so it was kind of a quick hire there.
Oh, so a little cash job.
Yeah, so which is, you know, like that was one of the challenging factors of moving into this area, especially back, you know, early 2000s, mid 90s. There wasn't a lot going on, you know, so work was, you know, kind of questionable, I guess. I thought, at least that was my interpretation, mm-hmm. You know. And so to get have a job lined up was, yeah, it was sort of like the nail in the coffin. And I'm like, I got to do this. I'm ready to do it.
That's really great. I'm going to take a break here.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Rufus Hawkey. You might recognize his voice. He he is the owner and manager of Key Waden Farms out by Viola, past Viola, toward where? Toward where? On the way to very tiny towns.
Yeah, in between Richland Center and Viola.
Kind of. Yeah, right. And you're listening to Digging Deep, which is our farming show on WDRT. 91.9 FM. We're streaming live on the internet, and you can also go to archives and look up Digging Deep and hear this show or other shows that we have done. And thanks for tuning in. We are on at noon on Saturdays. The last Saturday of the month is Digging Deep, but I haven't given up my cooking show, my food show, which is Who's in the Kitchen. That's the other Saturdays. And I'm Philothea Beeson. And so I've always wanted to know, again, what Key Waden means. And did your parents choose that name, or how did that come about?
Yeah, it was the name that my parents named the farm. It's an Ojibwe word. It means northwest wind or god of the north.
Oh, okay.
I kind of like the home wind interpretation of it, because I feel like the home wind kind of blew me home. And so, yeah, they had named it that. In the 70s, and kind of the reality is, like, we used to show cattle at the fairs and stuff, and so there was all this, like, memorabilia, fair stuff, like wood carvings and things.
With your farm name on
it. With the farm name on it, and so when I was thinking, like, what am I going to call the farm? I just sort of slipped into that. Excuse me. I just slipped into that, and that's what it's been so far. It might change, though.
So, yeah, I was going to say, what have you decided to do now? And I realize you probably, it's just evolving all the time, isn't it?
It is, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, because, part of the evolution is, like, the next generation, new people coming in. Yeah, business is always evolving, so, yeah, I don't know.
So you got a job at Avalanche Organics, being a driver, which meant, okay, then you got a lot of insight into what it was like raising produce.
It was a huge learning experience, yeah.
Awesome. Marketing and delivery, transportation, storage of crops and, produce and stuff like that. And doing it organically, that was, these are just lots of big steps, but that was the time where the concept of CSA developed, and I always try to tell people, who are out there in art farming, it's community-supported agriculture, which is just a wonderful idea where you kind of subscribe at the beginning of the season, and you guarantee to the farmer that you're going to buy a box of produce every week or every other week or whatever you agree to. So the farmer kind of has some stability, knows how much they're going to grow for, and actually has some money up front, right, to buy your seed and, to get equipment, hire people and stuff. Yeah, you do it with your family until you can't just do it with your family. Then you got to hire people.
Right.
It's a really big decision. But anyway, when did you decide, I'm going to do this on our farm?
Well, I moved back with the idea that I was going to be a vegetable farmer. That's primarily, based on the little garden that I did, which is like... comical. It is really comical.
The size of this table.
Yeah, it pretty much was. It was like really a small thing, but I was like, okay, I knew I didn't want to be a dairy farmer. I didn't want to, I was not really passionate about the animal side of things, but I really loved fresh food, and I just love all the cool vegetables. And, I guess the funny thing is the last year I was in Colorado, I was a lift op, right? So I'm in the lifts where the chairs go up.
Oh, right.
And I was on one lift that was like way up in the mountains and pretty out there. So we didn't get a lot of customers. So I would bring my garden books out there, and you weren't supposed to do this, but I'd be sitting there.
Well, there wasn't anything else to do.
Yeah, I know. And so I knew I wanted to veggie farm. And so that was where it was like, when I saw this, when I saw Avalanche Organics, it was just like, oh my God, this is the operation that maybe I want to be, you know? And so it was a great learning opportunity. And that first year back, I just worked for them and I didn't do much of farming on my own place, but it allowed me a chance. Like, the driving was great because I got to meet all the customers. I got to interact with the buyers. I got to see the store shelves and, you know, do that little bit of market research. I learned the products that they were growing. And then at that point, they were still doing a CSA, but they ended up stopping that and kind of like streamlining their production into some bigger commodity crops. But when I first started, they were still doing the CSA. They still had all these different crops. And so it was like a really awesome, diverse farm to see. And I drove, but I also worked in the fields. And so as a farm kid, they were like, well, you know how to drive tractor, right? And so, like, yeah, I did. I mean, I just... And so it was kind of cool, though, because it was like that... Because the vegetable world has got very specific, specialized equipment, and it's all kind of... There's, like, a little bit more tech to it, and... I mean, especially nowadays, but anyway, you know, it was great to be on that side and be able to see and use the equipment and see the different plants growing. And, you know, and then after that year, the second year working with them, they started to simplify their production. And so there was a couple crops that they were dropping from their production. And so I was like, hey, could I grow those things? And that's where I started with Swiss chard. That was the first thing I grew. And I had a contract with Willie Street Co-op. And all that sort of, like, one of the owners at Avalanche helped me to make that contact and finalize.
Yeah, you grow
things.
These vegetables, and then who's going to buy them? And then how are you going to get them there? And
totally. And so that was my trick, I guess, or whatever it was. I got to come in on some of these crops. I was still driving for them, so I could still meet with the buyers and find out what else they were wanting to purchase mm-hmm. from me possibly. Mm-hmm. And I got this, and I just had a nice slow start to it.
That was really fortuitous.
It was nice. It was nice. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing too is like when I first moved back, we certified the farm organic. That was 2004. And so that was a really important process too. And, you know, and then, you know, that those first 5 years, you have this just like incredible learning, what do you call it? Curve, your learning curve. And it's a lot of failure, a lot of failure.
Well, oh man, right? When we thought we were going to grow organic, we had no idea how we're going to control the weeds. I didn't realize weeds are, well, you know,
incredible.
Yeah. And you can only cultivate for so long, and then you can't get your tractor in between the crops. I mean, so that's why you need specialty equipment. Yeah, this is not corn and, you know.
No, it is.
It's something, you've got little rows, and you don't want to drive over your lettuce. And yet you've got, well, I know that I'm just going back to Avalanche Organics, because you might
them?
Have known Anton, because Anton worked there.
Oh, I do, totally.
And his friends, Danny O'Donnell, and there's a bunch of kids around Reedstown, and they came out, and on their hands and knees, they were hand weeding.
Oh, my God, seriously.
They were hand weeding.
I know. There were times when we would show up, and it would be like, okay, we have an order for 700 pounds of spinach to pick. And that was before they got their picking machine.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you are out there with a knife. Can you imagine,
like,
700
like
pounds?
China, like, Vietnam,
oh my gosh,
Thailand,
was,
you know.
Yeah, it was very not sophisticated in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And then you have the washing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's washers and tumblers, and, you know, when you get your...
drying,
oh, my gosh. And then how do you get it to Madison or whatever without it wilting? I mean, there are so many things in between the soil and the destination. This is why I decided to have a farming show.
Yeah.
Because I did a show for 14 years on food.
Yeah.
And I thought, do people really know what's involved in getting that food to market?
Like you did the cooking side of it.
I did the cooking. Sure. And yeah. I thought, people don't really know. And they still think that the farmer is really just a small farm, mother's in her apron throwing corn yeah. to the chickens.
Yeah.
And wait a minute. Oh, no, there's a lot of machinery involved, technique, and a lot of employees. Because Avalanche Organic was hiring people. I mean, they were doing it all.
They had like a staff of 30 or 40.
Oh,
maybe.
Gosh, yeah. Yeah. Well, then you have to manage payroll. And,
Yeah.
And advertising. And a lot of these farms, you know, started putting recipes into your box.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of a...
So
yeah.
that's a whole sideline yeah. where coming up with what do you do with broccoli? What do you do with kohlrabi? You know, when I don't have any idea what to eat, what part to eat.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
I was a kid like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So then you decided to expand what your crops were going to be kind of based on meeting with buyers and finding out what the demand was.
Yeah, well, so that was kind of an interesting time period. Early 2000s, there was this real growth of... we were in the growth market of organics, and that was, you know, a market that was expanding by 20, 30% every year in the early 2000s, you know, 90s, 2000s. I don't know what the growth is now, but it's still, you know, it's been a constantly expanding food market. Mm-hmm. Since I've been involved I've been involved around for 21 years now in the market.
Mm-hmm. Well, Organic Valley started up somewhere in that period of time.
They were in the mid-80s is when they started, right?
And they started with milk, I think.
They started actually with produce.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Yes, but and quickly shifted to milk.
Came to milk.
Yeah.
So did you ever sell to Organic Valley?
I do now.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Because that's... You know, that's something I bet you can look, and listeners, you can look at your dairy shelf and you'll find Organic Valley products.
Right, yeah.
And it is, what an idea. It was just started by a few idealistic kind of hippie type people out
here. Well, actually,
here.
It was a really pretty cool mix between some back-to-landers and the old Norwegian farmer guys that were out here still that were, you know, like kind of fighting against the idea of having to get big, you know. And the other thing we have out here that I think was sort of the ingredients in the recipe for what we have is that we have the hills. So we don't have farms that are conducive to like those small, large scale agriculture. I mean, it happens around here. I think nowadays like agriculture is pretty split between really, you know, commodity crop stuff and the small scale stuff, but yeah, it was a lot of these guys, you know, out in Cashton area and Chaseburg and around that area, you know, they wanted to keep small farms and they were trying to figure out how to make it into market.
Yeah, how do you sell this stuff and to know I have to have a contract and so Organic Valley is a co-op.
Yes, it is.
Of who?
It's a co-op of
farmers.
1,400 some farmers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was founded down in Lafarge, Wisconsin, and since then it's expanded. It's nationwide, predominantly dairy farms, but they do also have like an egg pool and a produce pool, and what else do they have? They do some meat sales. Yeah, it's been a really, you know, it's kind of. For this area, it was and it still is a really awesome economic driving force, and it's shaped, I think, who we are out here, and it's allowed a lot of small farms to still exist, and it is the largest organic food cooperative in the country for sure, maybe the world. I don't know. I don't want to get off my rocker here, but I think for sure in the country of organic, you know, specific. And
so these pieces got put together so that we really have kind of a quilt here of you know, buyers and growers, and we've grown the CSAs, we've got farmers markets, we've got a co-op, several food co-ops out here in southwestern Wisconsin, and they buy fresh.
Yeah.
It just, Yeah, there's ways.
So I kind of came into this period a pretty good time, and you know, what ended up happening was I worked with Avalanche Organics for a couple years until they ended up going out of business. So unfortunately, they were located in a really not good agricultural spot. I mean, the soil was great, but they're at the confluence of the Kickapoo River East and West Fork. And in the early 2000s, like 2008 up until I think 18 maybe or 16, we had these series of really devastating floods that came through and just wiped them out. That happened. They got wiped out. I had been working with them, so I kind of knew their product line. I knew their buyers, and I kind of just stepped into this role of like trying to fill that market. Mm-hmm. And I was still young and, you know, crazy enough to try to like really go big from where I was at. But that looked like, for me, it looked like some production on my farm, but then also trying to work with a bunch of other farmers in the area, because, you know, I knew I couldn't grow all that stuff. I didn't have the right setup. But I knew the market was there, too, though. So I started buying from a bunch of different farms to supplement my own growing.
That was an interesting venture.
It was. I learned a lot. I fell on my face big time a number of times, but learned a lot. I think the cool thing about that was I got to see a bunch of different other farms, too. I learned more about product. I learned about, you know, the trying to buy and sell, moving fresh stuff. Yeah, there was a lot. It was a huge learning experience. And so for maybe 5 or 6 years of my 7 years of my existence, I had this pretty rapid expansion of business. And I was in Minneapolis to Chicago, like driving, all that stuff, doing all, you know, just being a crazy man. And then at a certain point, I kind of just, it wasn't working, you know, financially and for me personally. You know, I was, you know, when you start something and you're just like, you look a couple years later and you're like, this isn't what I thought it was going to be, you know?
Well, yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And so I kind of had to go through this shrinking period. It was very humbling. I owed people money. It was not a fun time again, you know, but it also allowed me to like kind of get back to where I wanted to be, which
scaling.
Yeah. I really had wanted to be at around that 5-acre scale of gardening. To me, it seems like it's enough where you can make a living, mm-hmm. but it's not too crazy big where, you know, it just mm-hmm. is overwhelming. It felt like that, mm-hmm. or it still feels like that. And that's kind of where I'm at now today. So
you still grow a variety of vegetables?
A ton of stuff, yeah. We just had our first CSA harvest this week. And
you did, so mm-hmm. that's just before May. Okay, mm-hmm. that's interesting. Yeah, so the CSA crop, so what would be in a box?
Yeah, we packed a bunch of greens, so we packed tatsoi, mustard greens, arugula, salad mix, chives, cilantro, dill. We had some rutabagas and cabbages left over from the year before, stored, you know, from the year before.
Well, when you get into buying through a CSA, you really start learning about seasonal.
Yeah, you do, yeah.
You know, because here are your boxes. Where are the potatoes or where are the tomatoes? Yeah. Hey, they aren't, you know, they're not ready yet.
Yeah. There's been a lot of innovation in the CSA market, but we've actually kind of stayed old school because I kind of, you know, I don't know. This is the sadistic part of me. I like making people eat things they don't know about. I think people should have a food adventure. I think it's really easy for us to get locked into the standard stuff we buy, you know, and so, but there's so much good food out there. There's so many cool, strange vegetables, so many different colors of vegetables. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we basically pack 10, we try to pack 10 at least items per week in a box, and we try to keep it diverse, right? So we have to plant all kinds of different things, and we still do supplement from other farms.
I was just going to ask you that.
Yeah, we do.
Because, you can't maybe grow everything, but somebody may specialize in something.
That's the cool thing is there are some people that grow things better than I do. And, you know, some of that, sometimes I think that comes down to just like, I just don't like it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't.
You're not motivated.
I'm not motivated to grow it because I don't really enjoy it. And I mean, that's pretty rare. I really love all kinds of food. Mm-hmm. But
I keep thinking while I'm talking to you, I don't know if you ran across this book called The Triumph of Technique.
No, but it sounds fun.
I think you would really like it. Kind of the gist of it, it was written in by a reporter, I believe. And it's mostly about Iowa, but it is, it's about the idea, it was written in essays and then eventually put it into a book. But it's about the idea that you get a technique, you polish off a technique and then you apply it everywhere.
Mm.
And that has led to not very good outcomes.
Mm.
Because,
interesting.
You know, like you buy something, maybe orange beets or something like that, that you don't grow and you don't like them, but some, you know, you put them in a box. But the idea that somebody else's farm is not the same as yours.
Mm-hmm.
No farm is the same. Mm-hmm. No land is the same. You could grow grapes on one side of your hillside and the other side, they won't make it or whatever. The idea of technique that you can just plant it right onto any piece of land.
Mm.
All you need is water, fertilizer,
right.
You know, and you can do it anywhere.
Right.
And let's export it to India. Let's export it someplace
right.
else, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a limitation to that. And you have experienced, you know, they've got a lot more intricate techniques now for organic farming.
Absolutely.
And now people grow cover crops and they time the growing of things more, really observing your land and so forth, especially in the organic field, you know. But you realize this is very specific to my place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started, I have a little group that said, let's read it and discuss this book because it's very insightful. And I think it's kind of got implied to medicine.
Mm, sure.
You know, one size fits all.
Sure.
And people are going, well, what about food? And what about herbs? And what about homeopathics? And what, you know, I mean, there's just more than just plop down a certain plan and make it work, you know. So I think, you know, the triumph of technique, and I think we're going to discuss it on this show when we have just an hour for Joseph and me and a couple of people to maybe talk about the book, because at some point it's limited, and then it has bad side effects. So you're not treating the soil well, and the water that's running off is now polluting, and
what I would say is in agriculture, especially on the bigger scale, the only thing it seems that matters is production, and in my opinion, that's a rather narrow perspective to look at it. And so, that being said, I think that one of the challenges you have as a farmer is that you do need to systematize things. You do need mm-hmm. to collect data. You do need to, use some of the techniques that are out there for sure to help you understand what you're doing. But personally, and this kind of goes back to what you're saying about every farm being unique, personally, I find monocropping to be a little boring. Like, I'm not that interested in it. You know, I think I have much more fun experiencing the diversity that's out there and realizing, like, every year that I farm, I'm only touching the tip of the iceberg of what is out there, and I'm still growing, you know, 60, 70 different things. And, you know, that sometimes that feels overwhelming, growing too many things, right? You know, like you're spread too thin over too many things. But I can't quite help it personally. Like, I just
like all the flowers.
Yes, all the ridiculous, beautiful flowers. You know, so part of my own growing is just sort of shaped by the idea that I really do enjoy the diversity of things that we can do on our land, and I like. I like in our farm to like a easel or like a painting, right? You know, I'm the artist that gets to apply my thoughts to the land itself. And, you know, we have this amazing topography on our land too. So it's like you have these, we have two little side valleys. There's change of perspective that happens when you're moving through the land. And, yeah, I don't know. I just find it a lot more fun. So and I feel this way about a lot of things. Like I enjoy the co-op. I enjoy small restaurants that are unique. I enjoy, you know, all the different things that are not sort of monotonous. And I just don't find that. And I think a lot of people would, if they really think deeply about it, they would agree that you don't really find true happiness in the monotony of a single thing. I mean, we're curious creatures. We're meant to be moving around in a beautiful environment, and the environment is there for us to move around if we just open our eyes and see it. If we, you know, I think the coolest thing I see in, like, as we're talking about the evolution of this whole business and life and organic stuff, you know, all the cool things that were started, you know, by your generation, you know, or also practiced through the human life, you know, as long as we've been around, we have to understand that we're just in this really weird, unique bubble of time where most people are living not the way humans usually live. And it's not like I live a pure life or whatever you want, but I am outside and it's amazing. It's amazing watching the world go by.
All day. All pretty day, much eight, yeah. All day through till the sun sets. Through all weather. And so now we're kind of coming to a change of a phase.
Sure.
I just know a little bit about your farm, but it's really becoming a place that you share with other people. And it's a really cool idea. It's not just your family and a few employees, but you got this idea somewhere along the line, maybe you and your wife together.
For sure.
To reach out and say, let's share this farm with other people. Let's use this beautiful land to bring people out. And so tell me about how that developed. When did that happen?
Yeah, so I've been kind of plugging along in the vegetable world for 21 years. And then my wife, Joy, came to the farm in 2017. And we just clicked right away. You know, it's like when you move through life with the person that you love, it's pretty awesome. And, you know, but of course she came onto the farm and needed to find her identity. You know, it's challenging when you're partnering up with a person who basically the farm is my identity or has been my whole, you know.
Yeah.
And so she joked that she fell in love with farming, a farmer, and the farm, right? So she kind of understood she needed to do that, but within that space, it's like you have to figure out what your passion is and what your thing you want to do. And so 2020 happened, the pandemic happened, we started getting just random calls from people to just come out and hang out on the land and get away from town. And you know, it was like a weird kind of interesting experience. And we'd see these people come out and, you know, we're out there. And so we're kind of in our own little world of, I was not quite aware of how isolating that experience was for people. And isolating, not just in the sense of being disconnected from humans, but also just the environment. And so people would come out and hike. And then, you know, we started thinking about, like, you know, the loss of farms and farm culture and being on the land. And we just felt like we wanted to share our place with people. And so in 2020, we started a nonprofit called Driftless Curiosity. And we came to the name Driftless Curiosity mostly being because we're, by nature, Joy and I are just kind of curious people. And we like learning all kinds of different things. And we realize we're in this place and space in the world where there's all these unique entrepreneurs and people just doing fun, ridiculous things out here that, you know, or just, it can be as simple as old school-y things like canning, you know, people are doing that, or, you know, and so we knew there was a resource of knowledge out here, and we wanted to really pair that with our land, which the land itself is just really beautiful. And I think, I don't want to overstate it, but maybe awe-inspiring. And, you know, I mean, people do have this like visceral reaction to being out there. And
it's a pretty spectacular view.
It is a pretty, yeah, yeah, it's an incredible,
I mean,
view.
It's,
yeah,
not
it really
just
is.
Flat, and yeah, yeah, it's very
and as we've evolved the landscape too, you know, we've sort of tried to bring in this element of, like, we're trying to mesh agriculture with the environment and show that you can grow a lot of food, but also there can be lots of beautiful diversity around us. It doesn't have to be an either or. We can do both.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a real strong movement of really knowledgeable people that are out there doing that same, having that same conversation. It's really cool to be a part of it. And so through Driftless Curiosity, it's a 501c3 nonprofit. We've been able to bring out experts and have events, and we've had all kinds of crazy fun art-related stuff. We did an adult summer camp 1 year. We've had stuff focused around food and growing and foraging and building and maple syrup and
Day of the Dead. That's where I came out.
Yeah, Day of the Dead has been a huge festival for us, and that's been a really just amazing collaboration with some really beautiful people. And the most, from my perspective, for that event, the thing that I really cherish the most is growing all those flowers and seeing people interact with the flowers. It really is something special. And so yeah, that one's probably our biggest attendance event. Last year we had probably 800 people out, and we had 5 different food vendors and built an ofrenda and did all kinds of fun stuff. And we work with Gabriella's. She's kind of like our main, although there's a team of awesome people now that help us do this thing. And Gabriella, she's got a radio show here, right, on WDRT, right, on Saturdays?
I'm not sure when it is.
Yeah, okay, anyway, she's an awesome, awesome person that we've really had a fun time working with.
Yeah, wanting to share her culture.
Yeah, so we've been doing that for Driftless Curiosity has been in existence, okay, for 5 years now, and I really think, like, this year, I feel like we've kind of come into another level of doing these things, because I think for a while, like with any good entity, you're trying to figure out what your identity is and what kind of events we want to host up there. But now we're really starting to, it seems like, get a good group of experts that come out and help us host these events, like Wild Farm Alliance. Is that, did I say it right?
Mm-hmm.
I always kind of screw up the names. But yeah, they helped us put on a birding event yesterday, actually. And
yeah,
we had 40 some people out, and just got to learn all kinds of really cool stuff about ag's interaction with birds, and how we can all, and then not just specifically ag too, but like how we can interact with these awesome creatures, promote them, help them live their lives, and all the wonderful things they give back to us, right? And so we had people from the Land Stewardship Network out there. We had, who else was out there? Audubon was out there. I know I'm forgetting somebody.
Yeah. But you don't have to be the expert.
No.
You provide the setting.
We provide the setting,
yeah. And then you can bring in people. It sounds really wonderful, and it is really evolving.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the cool part about it, from my perspective, is I will bring the agricultural aspect or the landowner's aspect of, like, how do we make a living? How do we exist out on the land, but also do all these really cool things, specifically like with birds? Mm-hmm. How do we cut our hay? How do we do all these things that we want to do and need to do as agriculturalists,
mm-hmm,
out there? And that's just a small piece of the, like, so next month we have a shepherdess workshop, and Joy's partnered up with 5 or 6 other shepherdesses in the area that are doing really cool work, and Utopia, which is an awesome business. I mean, like, right, we have all these cool things around us, don't we?
I know. We really have so many resources, and I just want to take a break and let people know we're talking about Key Waden Farm. If you're just going, will you please identify who your guest is? This is Rufus Hockey. He founded the vegetable aspect of his parents' dairy farm called Key Waden. It's out by Viola, east of Viroqua, northeast, I guess. And, went from just doing produce, growing a lot of flowers, and really trying to figure out what do you do with 200 acres,
Right.
And so how it's really evolving and turning into like these curiosity events where you can see the land in relation to so many different activities. And this is what I just love. I love the idea of realizing that the food and the farm and the land, they all interact with the community and other aspects of what's going on. This is such a lively place to be living, and I wish it could be just captured and moved to other locations, because we have a lot of dead towns around here. I mean, there's nothing there. And I'm thinking, Viroqua is so alive, but it doesn't have to be the only town that's alive. And there are farms which are doing really fabulous things, and there's great cheese factories, cheese out here, and more interest in the utopia, having a woolen mill here where people who raise sheep can have their cleaned and carded and made into yarn, and they even dye the yarn there. And it's like reviving some of these old practices and making them possible to actually, you might never feel like you make money doing these things, but you love them.
Sure.
You love them. I know people who do sheep, and they do the whole wool thing and spinning and everything, and they're never going to really get rich from it, but they're driven. I mean, they just love it. And I've been out to a farm where we have gone out into the pasture and harvested Monarda bee balm, wild bee balm, and brought it in and boiled it in pots and dyed the wool that very day from all the wild plant dyeing. There's so much going on. Then we have, the Winding Roads Art Festival, and then you get to drive around with a map, and
we'll be on the map. Yeah.
You'll be on the map. Okay.
Yes, my mother-in-law, she has her pottery studio out there.
Oh, right. That's right, Charna. And so, you get to see where the artists live and see their studios and how they have merged with the land and contribute to the richness of our culture out here.
I think it's really important, adding art to the land. It's one of the parts one of my favorite parts about Driftless Curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that in the traditional sense, I've never actually done any art. I had never done any art until Driftless Curiosity. And then just through the awesomeness of having experts out that are so patient with you and show you things, it's like all of a sudden you realize, oh, you can do art too.
Right. Really, you think if you can't draw a horse, you give up,
know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like then there's so much more.
Yeah, like when you come to the farm, you'll see a giant mural on the front of our barn. That was in a collaboration with a muralist who actually did the mural at Utopia too. But he kind of set it up for us, so it was like paint by number thing, right? And then we got to do this thing. And that was part of our adult summer camp, which was really cool because we had a bunch of us. Like, there was one lady in particular. She had come from Chicago, and she was like spray painting out there, And we were just joking, like she had sent pictures to her grandkids because she's like tagging our barn, and she was like, she would never have imagined she would have done that, but.
Aww.
And then we had a metals workshop a couple years back where we took a bunch of farm junk and made it into sculptures. And
oh, fun.
Yeah, that was cool.
Oh, that's,
people were welding, and it was pretty wild, but it was fun.
Well, let's give some contact information. If people want to know what's going on, you have a website?
Yeah, driftlesscuriosity.org, driftlesscuriosity.org. Okay.
And your farm is spelled how?
K-E-E-W-A-Y-D-I-N, farms with an S, .com.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, remember that I-N.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Key Waden, and you have a Facebook page too.
We do. Yeah. Joy has a Driftless Curiosity Facebook page. She blogs almost every day.
And this just amazes me too, because that it consumes time.
Oh gosh.
I mean. Yeah. So there's not just the land and the vegetables and the events, but
no.
But you had a program. I understand, you know, and you have bios of the people who are presenting.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
This doesn't just happen just with a snap of fingers. This
no,
is
Joy's
a lot
amazing.
Of work.
Joy is the Joy. Is
She's the media person.
She mostly, yeah. I do have a YouTube channel.
You do?
Yeah. It's called Joy on the Land with Rufus.
Oh, my gosh.
It's small but growing.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I'm pretty dorky, so I'm trying to have fun about it.
I am so glad you have been on Digging Deep. This has been a lot of fun, and I've meant to do it for months or years.
Are we done already?
Yep. A year,
oh my
an
God.
Hour went by. It's amazing how that goes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I really wanted, we did exactly what I hoped we could do. I wanted to share that peek into the past that kind of slipped away, that time has really changed, and we'll never really be able to go back, I don't think, to the kind of farming that your parents did. I mean, even 60 cows was a lot of cows. Some people had 12.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like you got to have 200 or 400 to make it go, you know. And then, you know, you being growing up here and then moving away, and really seeing, oh, this land, I mean, my parents are thinking of selling it and thinking of how, what could I do, and how things just fell into place, you know, meeting the Avalanche Organic people you know, just it's been a wonderful little journey in history. And seeing what you're doing now and what will happen in the future is just, you know, it's you don't know because you're curious. Yeah, and you're inventive.
If I still have enough time here, I will tell you, I am an optimist, and I think that there's a lot of beautiful things coming to us. I really do. I mean, I think that it's really important for people to remember that we're living in a time period where the earth is in its perfect age. We can grow all kinds of things. The environment is, it can be healthy. It's up to us, right? And to encourage or support movements and our own personal journey. And I know it feels like it can be overwhelming at times. And you know, certainly there's lots of things that we can talk about that way. But the reality is that the earth wants to provide for us. It really, really does. It really does. And it's an intricately beautiful system that's already set up. If we just open our eyes, and, you know, we're here to try to do our little part. And it for each and every one of us, it is just a really little part. You don't have to take it all on. You really don't.
Well, I was just at the Earth Day celebration at the co-op, and one of the booths was paper cups with a little bit of soil in it, and you get to get a seed and plant it.
Yeah.
And what a vision. It just can start with a seed, and I tell you, kids absolutely love that, and they will develop an interest in growing radishes and maybe a pumpkin, then saving the seed from what you ate, saving it from a pepper or a pumpkin, and planting it again, and getting that idea that in nature, just it will reproduce itself. It's so magical.
It really
isn't
is.
It?
It's, it is
it's
the
biblical.
Most, it's the most magical thing. And I run into younger people all the time that are really enthusiastic about it, and they understand, I think, our relationship with the world has to change a little bit. We have to make these small steps, and sometimes that small step can be really small, like just planting one seed. You know, you grow one seed, one tomato, one something. Just have that. Have your hands in the dirt a little bit. That's all it takes.
That's all it takes. Have your hands in dirt. And yeah. Boy, yesterday was the day I just couldn't stay away from the dirt. It felt so right? good, so perfect.
Didn't it feel so good? Oh.
Yes. So thank you, Rufus Hockey, for being on Digging Deep.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'm Philothea Beeson, and you've been listening to Digging Deep on WDRT 91.9 FM. We're community radio. We're all volunteers, and we're loving sharing this information with our listening audience. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back again on next Saturday at noon.
Bye now.
Bye.